You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives.
Hi everyone, I'm Ben Kiebrick, and today's show we are taking on the topic of uncivil rhetoric. We've got some great guests. First, an interview with Nancy Welch, where she talks about the location and perspective of composition and rhetoric in relation to social movements and the overlap between scholarship and activism in her own experience. Then we get to talking about the role of so-called uncivil rhetoric and the necessity of challenging those in power.
Then we talk with two local activists, Ursula Rosam and Amelia Ramsey Lefebvre, who interrupted President Obama as he spoke at a local high school. They describe raising the issue of Chelsea Manning's unjust imprisonment directly to the person with the power to set her free.
So first, Nancy Welch and I sat down in a conference room at the Conference on College Composition and Communication. I asked Welch about her experiences in social and activist movements and how it might relate to her perspective on the scholarship in composition and rhetoric.
Well, I think that, you know, much of my current work comes out of my experiences of being involved in a variety of struggles that I became involved in not as a researcher or as a compositionist, but because facing a set of challenges and difficulties and needing to do something about it. So it can be anything from trying to defend an abortion clinic and the right of women to go in without being harassed to seek whatever services they are seeking, to trying to stop a campus writing center from being closed, to trying to organize faculty into a union at a time when our healthcare is being dismantled. And my involvement in, you know, any number of local struggles, national struggles, you know, I guess I would say positioned me as a student of public rhetoric, public argument, in a way that I found was incredibly rich and creative and instructive, and that also seemed, you know, somewhat out of step with what I had been taught in the field, what I had learned, how I was teaching and working with my own students. And so I found myself wanting to bring those lessons and ideas into the classroom. And by that, I don't mean bringing them in order to somehow turn my classrooms into social movements. But it seemed to me that that my classroom should be a place where we are talking about and studying and learning from a whole history of really rich, vibrant public argument that otherwise was not being represented in our composition textbooks, in composition readers, and, you know, to, you know, by and large, in terms of our composition journals and scholarship.
Next, I ask Welch about how she sees the institutional and intellectual location of composition in relation to democratic struggles.
When I think about what it is about composition's placement in the academy that might align us more with social and economic justice, I think that it is not because of the prestige and the disciplinary recognition. It is because of our proximity to working class people, people who have been traditionally excluded from the academy, from halls of power. It's really that location that certainly shaped how I came into the university. I went to an urban open admissions university with faculty who had really been shaped by the struggles for public education and access of the late 1960s into the 70s. I think of that as being really what shaped the field of composition, and that I think is really what should give our field a sense of its ethos and its authority.
Given the culture and political conditions we live in today, I asked Welch what responsibilities she thought scholars in the field have.
We have a dual role, and so one is to actually look outward to all of the ways in which people are trying to, you know, organize and act for change today. So that can mean from the Arab Spring to the Madison State House takeover to Occupy Wall Street to the Chicago teacher strike, you know, the ways in which people are trying to come together and change the direction of not just this country, but what's happening around the globe. I also think most recently of Idle No More rising up against the tar sands pipeline and the destruction that that would cause. So part of it is about looking outward, but it's not just about looking outward. It's also looking at what's happening on our campuses, what's happening in our own programs, who is actually doing the composition teaching, and who are the students in our classrooms, what kind of debt have they gone in to be there, and to simultaneously be looking back at history of how the right to public higher education was won in the first place, and trying to figure out what it is that we do now to both, I think, link up with the different struggles that are happening beyond campus, but to also bring those struggles to our campuses, because we really need to fight for free public higher education and livable wages for all people doing the work of teaching education. So I guess that's part of what I want to bring into the mix too, is that when I think about public rhetoric, public composition, the public work of composition, that theme of the conference, it is not just about looking beyond campus, but it's really taking a hard look at what's happening in our own field and figuring out how do we do what the Chicago teachers did.
Considering the responsibilities to challenge corporatized higher education and the democratic movements that Welch has participated in, I asked her for advice on untenured faculty or graduate students that might be interested in participating in similar work.
Before I had tenure, I was involved in organizing our faculty union. And at that point, I decided to do two things. One was to never do anything on my own, but also to be very visible. But to be very visible with others. And I decided that the safest place for me to be was very visibly out there helping to organize this union with other people, so that it would make it harder for the administration to single me out or to retaliate, because it would be very obvious that they were singling me out and retaliating for being active in this union drive, and that I would have a lot of other people with me who would be outraged if that were to happen. Since then, I've just have always tried to make sure that whatever I'm doing bring others along with me. One, because it's just not sustainable for one person to try to do everything. Two, one person doesn't have the vision, the consciousness, the knowledge, the perspective that's really needed to know what is the right thing to be doing and to be arguing for. And then also, there's always just a great deal more safety and power in numbers. And the interesting thing to me on my own campus, because I know that there's a lot of concern about, well, we can't do anything that's too out there because those who are the most vulnerable will be targeted and so forth. On my own campus, whenever we have had some kind of public demonstration against budget cuts, against layoffs, the faculty and staff who have turned out in the greatest numbers are those with the least amount of security. So there were two things. One is that feeling the greatest need to turn out, and then also feeling like because what was being organized was something very big, something very public with a lot of people, feeling safety in those numbers as well. But I do feel a concern about tenured faculty saying, oh, we shouldn't organize anything public because that would be too risky, and then they don't turn out. I think that there's a lack of understanding about what tenure is for. You know, if you have this protection, then you should use it. And you should use it not in the ways that are the most comfortable for you, which might be backroom discussions with administrators, but instead, you know, you should be putting yourself out there, I think.
Talking more about social movement rhetoric, I asked Welch about the popular representation of social movements in our culture and in the field of composition and rhetoric.
Just because it's on my mind right now, maybe I'll start with an example. A lot of people I know are watching the Netflix series House of Cards, and there was an episode recently that represented a national teacher strike, and it represented that strike as this angry tumult in the same way that the strike wave in the Progressive Era was also represented as an angry tumult, disorderly mob. And, you know, in 1912, as in 2012, a real democratic strike is not an angry tumult. It is really very much a joyous discovery. I'm thinking here particularly not of the representation of the teacher strike on House of Cards, but instead the actual teacher strike that took place recently in Chicago. And the teachers who took part in that during the strike, after the strike, what they said again and again was that they had discovered themselves and they had discovered each other. They had discovered their students' parents, their communities through that experience. And so at the same time, though, those teachers were vilified in 1912. The Bread and Roses strikers were vilified as being an angry mob. And so we have again and again that representation of any kind of collective from below democratic voice and argument as being uncivil, as being a mob. And I think that compositionists have really, instead of really studying and learning the lessons of those kinds of actions, have bought into it, have accepted the kind of ruling class line that we need to have lone mediators to prevent these kinds of arguments from happening to begin with.
Finally, Welch reflects on Dr. John Carlos's talk, where he described the silent protest at the 1968 Olympics. This talk happened just before our interview, so it was fresh in our minds.
There was something that John Carlos said in his remarks today, something to the effect of, why is it that you want to make your oppressors feel comfortable? And I think that when we look at rhetorical means in relation to people who are making decisions that are destroying the planet, that are destroying people's lives, that are immiserating and incarcerating large numbers of especially people of color around the country and around the globe, we should not be concerned about making them comfortable. We should not be concerned about finding a seat at their table. We should be thinking about how it is that we get together so that collectively we can make them very uncomfortable so that we can change them. And again, to do this collectively, democratically, in a way that we discover ourselves and each other. So it's not about one person going it alone, but it is also not about negotiating and mediating with a group of people who have shown themselves to not care about the things that I think we do deeply care about, including the future for most of our students who are not going to be those elites.
Welch's final point seems like a fitting segue to talking with Ursula Rosam and Amelia Ramsey LaFave, who challenged President Obama on the unjust imprisonment of Chelsea Manning, the Army intelligence analyst who blew the whistle on war crimes that she witnessed in classified documents. Manning was charged with aiding the enemy, which carried a possible life sentence. She was found not guilty on that particular charge, but still sentenced to 35 years in prison. Amelia and Ursula are both staff at the Syracuse Peace Council. I should note that their action took place on the same day that Chelsea Manning officially changed her name from Bradley Manning. So Ramsey LaFave and Rosam's sign and message reflects Chelsea's prior gender identity and name. Here they describe what happened and their planning for the action, including how they got some advice from Madea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, who has some expertise in interrupting figures of power for social justice.
So on Thursday, August 22nd, myself and Amelia attended President Obama's public talk at Henninger High School in Syracuse, which was held in the gym there. And we got into the gymnasium with a banner tucked under my skirt and that said "Free Bradley Manning." And it was pretty crowded, and we were positioned pretty perfectly at the top of the gymnasium bleachers, right across from the TV cameras and like diagonal to the president. Protests were expected, and so we got some advice from Medea Benjamin at Code Pink that a cloth banner is actually quite easy to sneak in, and it was.
We had some choice about when we got in whether we wanted to go into the standing section, which would be right in front of Obama, or go up into the bleachers on the side. If we stand, we could be a little closer to him and maybe closer, potentially closer to the media, because another piece of advice that Medea gave us is that we might want to position ourselves near the TV camera so they would pick up any audio. But we went for the bleachers, and I think that was a good choice because Obama could see us really clearly, and as Ursula said, it was really easy to photograph us up there.
So Ursula held the banner, "Free Bradley Manning," while Amelia spoke these words.
I said, "President Obama, you must free Private Manning. With all due respect, Private Manning exposed torture, Private Manning exposed war crimes. Private Manning aided the public and not the enemy."
And to get a sense of what these words feel like spoken to the president in a room packed with hundreds of people, here's the audio from the event itself. As Ursula and Amelia mentioned, they're positioned away from the microphones, so Amelia is quickly drowned out by the somewhat raucous crowd.
But as any middle-class family will tell you, we are not... I hear you. I got you. No, this is fine. Wait. We're okay.
And the crowd here keeps booing for a while as President Obama tries to quiet them.
That's okay. Hold on a second. Hello, everybody, hello. Hey. Hold on a minute, sir. Hold on. So, now, you know, hold on a second. Can I just say that as hecklers go, that young lady was very polite. She was. And, you know, she brought up an issue of importance, and that's part of what America's all about.
So I asked them for some background. Why did they pick this issue and venue? And what was the response that they got from their action?
And for me, part of it is we're part of this larger national movement. And so when we're in Syracuse and we have this opportunity in front of us, my thought was that anyone in the country that has been paying attention to the treatment of Bradley Manning should take the opportunity to, you know, call out President Obama on this issue because he ultimately has the power.
Mm-hmm. What has been the media response? I mean, have you been able to get that message out?
Well, a lot of the headlines that I have seen are like, say, Manning supporters interrupt Obama's speech. So, you know, while there's an unfortunate emphasis on, the decorum or, you know, it was rude and it wasn't the right venue or whatever, like, people bring up the issue at least by acknowledging what we were there to say, even if they don't go into a deeper conversation about it, which would be our hope.
Ursula talked a bit more about the response that they got from the media here.
The responses have been like, you know, Manning's a traitor and Ursula Rosam's rude and, you know, those women abuse their freedom and have no respect for Obama, without actually acknowledging the information that Manning released. And so that's been really, you know, the most frustrating. What's irked me a little bit about the coverage is this idea that we were heckling Obama, and that phrase is really troublesome because, you know, we weren't heckling, we weren't, you know, insulting the president, we were delivering a message, which is, I think, really different than heckling, because mm-hmm. heckling is, you know, you shout insults and things like that. So I think, you know, that's why we try to be very clear when we're putting out statements that we are interrupting, we're using our right of free speech. Amelia was very polite in her language, I think intentionally, towards the president.
Then I asked Amelia what she thought of speaking directly to President Obama.
You know, you sort of expressed interest in like you said, like, what was it like to speak to the potentially most powerful person, you know? And so it did feel like I spoke to Obama and he heard me and he responded to me. And, like, so one part of me, like, on a personal level, feels really empowered about that. And I feel like, wow, that was a great action. And he heard me, right? But, and then on the other hand, he's very respectful of people like us and like Medea Benjamin who interrupt him, but it sort of almost allows him to just be that much more dismissive of it, right? He says, oh yeah, that's really important, but, you know, he's not actually addressing our concern. I don't really have hope that we swayed him. I mean, I sort of, you know, in my heart of hearts, it's like, maybe tonight when he's going to sleep on that bus, he'll remember, he'll be like, oh, shit, you know, maybe I need to think about that, but, like, probably not, right?
Yeah.
So.
And after explaining what they did in their action, I was curious about if they would support this sort of method of interruption as a tool for naming and exposing injustice elsewhere.
I guess I wouldn't make the leap to say that because it felt appropriate this time that it's always the best method, or that I would recommend it for everyone, or that we should always do this or something. As long as the protesters, you know, there were legal protesters outside of the speech, are like being cordoned off and they're like free speech zone 3 blocks away where they can be ignored, then probably this kind of method is going to continue to be necessary.
All right, so that's the show for today. Thanks to Amelia Ramsey Lefebvre, Ursula Rosam, and Nancy Welch for being on the show and for helping to describe the necessity of challenging those who are in power and raising issues of social justice, inequality, and oppression. Thanks for the work you all do. This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.